This is the current federal tax developments for the week of December 14th, 2020. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and by your state society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers, and this week we're going to be looking at a number of issues that occurred this week in the area of federal taxes. And we're going to start out this week by looking at a couple of things. First, we're going to take a look at the IRS, which brought out this week a new Q&As on CARES Act Section 102 and 103. Actually, this time at least it's not FAQs. It actually is a formal notice, so I guess that's good news compared to what we've been seeing otherwise from the service. Also, we have a new letter. You may remember a couple weeks ago we talked about the IRS commissioner telling us that we're going to receive no additional penalty relief when he spoke at an AICPA conference. Now, the AICPA and six other organizations have sent him another little letter suggesting that maybe he should reconsider this idea. So we'll see if that gets us anything. Not sure if it will. The SBA gave us some guidance this week, or actually they gave guidance to the banks, about reporting payments under CARES Act Section 1112. That is the section that dealt with the SBA would pay 6 months worth of principal, interest, and fees on any SBA loan that a borrower had taken out. The SBA this week confirmed that there are going to be 1099 miscellaneous issued on that income, therefore, and also tells us that it's taxable. That's not exactly surprising, because remember, they did not write any special provision for those payments like they did for the PPP loans forgiveness, which had 1106I in the CARES Act. There was no equivalent provision for 1112. So this means that, yeah, we're going to be seeing those 1099s come out. And the SBA actually finally formally agreed and told us something on paper about their forms 3509 and 3510. Those are the forms that were being issued basically to borrowers that got a loan of over $2 million. Now going to find out what that means and what the SBA will do with that information. But let's go on to our first topic this week, and this will be Notice 2020-86. That was issued on December 9th. And what this notice does is gives us a set of Q&As, right, related to a couple of provisions in the CARES Act. These are provisions that made some changes to 401k plans, specifically Section 102 and Section 103 of the CARES Act. Those are the key areas we're looking at here. And what this does, 102 looked at the changes in the maximum allowed automatic enrollment. And there we have three questions that are fairly basic. Nothing really, I mean, they deal with some edge case issues, but they're there, give us that. We have a lot more questions that deal with the other section, which is CARES Act Section 103, which in that case, that one is dealing with changing your safe harbor, going to a essentially across the board safe harbor payment for a 401k plan. It was a safe harbor 401k plan, moving away from an alternative. The issue there, though, is it gets a lot more complicated. They have 10 questions and answers here that deal with just a ton of special cases. And actually, it's kind of interesting. There was an article in Tax Notes Today Federal, give that right title, that essentially said that once you got done with that to see what you're going to be doing if you're giving notices, because again, a lot of this is, well, we don't have to give this notice, but there's these other notices that really should have been given, and saying at the end of the day, it's probably going to be a lot of people come to conclusion, what we really should do is just go ahead and do what we've always done and not worry about the relief they gave us in the CARES Act. Because it turns out that relief wasn't so great. Next, we have this AICPA, this letter. The letter in question comes from not only the AICPA in this case, but we also had Alliant Group, the National Association of Enrolled Agents, National Association of Tax Professionals, the National Conference of CPA Practitioners, the National Society of Tax Professionals, and Pagé Business Services, all of which were, you know, signed off on this letter issued on December the 7th. Now, of course, what exactly was this letter? Well, if you remember, we talked a couple weeks ago that the commissioner of the IRS, Commissioner Chuck Reddick, had spoken to the AICPA's National Conference on Federal Taxes. And during his speech, he had said effectively that there would be no additional blanket level or special relief granted for things like late filing due to COVID-19. And he said basically that, yeah, it was no way. There was nothing of that type, and that we really shouldn't be looking for that, right? Well, now this week, we get a letter coming from these seven organizations, the AICPA and the others that I've listed for you. And what this does is they start asking for some very specific levels of relief. And one of the key things we're looking at here is trying to give a simplified reasonable cause relief issue. And one of the things they did ask for, kind of interesting, was a set of causes that could be self-certified by a taxpayer for qualifying for relief. One of the problems they've noted is that a lot of the reasons why people need this relief has come from the fact that we're having trouble right now with the IRS and communication. And that means that a lot of these notices are flying out because the IRS is just so far behind in processing things that notices fly out and you can't really get a hold of somebody in time to stop notices. So they're saying, look, we should really just kind of this one. You guys are clearly, you know, you're causing as many problems, if not more, than the taxpayers are. And taxpayers are struggling right now with a lot of issues happening currently, especially as we see another surge in COVID cases. We see additional steps being taken by state and local governments in the area. So there's a lot going on right now. And saying, realistically, IRS, probably need to go back, rethink this, Commissioner, and redo relief. Whether this will do anything, we'll have to see. I'm not sure it's going to make that much difference, but at least they all got back on the record and stating that they're going down this. Next up, this one, probably some people listening will not be happy with this. But this was guidance given out by the SBA, and it was given out on December the 8th. And it's notice number 5000-20067, entitled Tax Issues Relating to Payments Made on Behalf of Borrowers under Section 1112 of the CARES Act. Now, that particular provision, if you weren't aware of it, is, or at least you probably were, but everybody's kind of forgotten at this point. That was the provision that said we're going to give you 6 months worth of payments on loans, any 7A loans. Under the Small Business Act, under Section 7A, these loans, and that includes things like the emergency loans. Technically, PPP loans are under that list as well. We have a lot of different things in there. But for those other 7A loans they have had coming into the COVID situation, we're going to go ahead and we're going to make 6 months worth of payments on those. Now, the question obviously became right away is this taxable income? And the answer of this, well, the first thing they tell us, which pretty much gives away what the answer is this document is discussing who has to issue the 1099 miscellaneous with regard to these payments. Now, obviously, there's no 1099 miscellaneous issue unless you're going to have some taxable income. So right off the bat, we know that we have a taxable income issue in regard. And what the SBA says in this regard is that if the loan is in the name of the bank, or if the SBA may have bought back the loan, but the bank is still servicing it, the bank will issue the 1099 in the bank's name. The bank will name themselves as the basically the payor, and they will name the borrower as the recipient of that money, even though it's being directly paid by the SBA to the bank. They also say that if the loan in question is one that requires 1098 mortgage reporting, you will still report the interest that's being paid by the SBA on the 1098 going to the taxpayer. Now, let's try to answer the basic question everybody's going to have right off, which is, well, is this really taxable income? My guess is it is. Section 61 is very, very broad and generally says that gross income is income from any source whatsoever. And the way the Internal Revenue Code is structured, you've got to find something to take that out of that category. And the Supreme Court has kind of looked at this as a more general, what they'd call an accession to wealth concept. You know, have we actually had an increase in our net worth because of whatever took place? And obviously, if the federal government goes ahead and pays these mortgage payments, I don't care if it's the federal government or it's whoever, somebody walks in and pays those mortgage payments, yeah, I'm better off than if they hadn't walked in and done that. Financially, I'm in better shape. So that looks like income. Now, the more interesting aside we had, which they do not appear going this route because they're going to issue a 1099 miscellaneous and not a 1099C, is that they are saying it is probably other income. Remember, it's not going to be a non-employee compensation issue because non-employee compensation doesn't go on 1099 miscellaneous this year. It goes on the 1099 NEC. Hopefully you remember that, right? We had that up. So it's not going to be non-employee comp. It'll probably be just other income on the 1099 miscellaneous. But they could have said 1099C, right? I mean, cancellation of debt. But I think the SBA's position is probably correct, at least for the loans that they have not bought back, you know. But if they haven't bought back a loan, realistically, the entity you owe money to, even though the SBA is guaranteeing the loan, you owe the money back to, let's say, whatever bank it might be it Wells Fargo, whoever. So I owe the money back to them. And they're not forgiving anything. They're getting paid, right? Money's coming in the door. So because of that, it's not really cancellation of debt. Now, you might think, cares? I mean, ordinary income is ordinary income. Should I really be worried about whether it's cancellation of debt or whether it's just standard ordinary income? Seems like I got the same problem. Not really. It's potentially a difference if you qualify, let's say, for Section 108 relief, especially 108A1B, which is insolvent. If a debt is canceled while the taxpayer is insolvent, then we do not include that income. Now, we will reduce attributes going into the following year, but we will not have to pay tax on that cancellation of debt income. Here's the catch. As I say, if it's not that and it's just ordinary income, it won't matter if you're insolvent. As I say, my guess is it makes perfect sense why if I owe money to Wells Fargo, the fact that Bank of America might be paying it is not going to change anything, right? That's just going to be the same thing we've always had. So nothing really different's going on. But if instead we're looking at the fact that somebody else is paying it, right? You know, that a third party's paying it, that's more related to income. So it's not a cancellation rule. Now, also, we should recognize, and the reason why they tell us on the 1098 for the mortgage, report the interest. The interest is reported even if the SBA pays it for the taxpayer. And that reason is because if it's taxable income, if I'm recognizing the income, then I'm going to be able to deduct the interest. The interest expense should still be deducted on the return. Now, this doesn't cover this, but it's probably related, and the answer is probably going to be the same. The question becomes, what about those EID grants? Remember those up to $10,000, you don't have to pay them back. Those also appear to be an accession to wealth. Now, again, is it a bad debt? Well, probably not because it's a grant. You were never expected to pay it back. Because of that, it seems like it's more likely to be just plain old ordinary income. Again, we've not had a ruling. And interesting enough, this ruling is coming from the SBA, not from the Internal Revenue Service, but probably it's correct. Remember, the SBA is part of Treasury, so presumably they've at least talked to the IRS about this issue, and they actually do have a contact information on the document to contact. Actually, I think I talked to you to contact the Taxpayer Advocate's Office, or I forget whichever one. The information person locally. If you have questions about this, that's actually been bank. But for practical purposes, yeah, it's income. So doing those year-end projections, if you thought your only question was, what do we do about that, you know, PPP loan, the expenses paid with that? Well, this has also been an issue for anybody that already had an SBA loan coming into this and who's had those 6 months of, you know, of the obligations taken care of by the government. We have income there too. So that's going to be another issue. Now, we also, this week, interestingly enough, we got our first acknowledgement by the SBA. Well, I mean formal. They had actually acknowledged in other forms, in various articles. We had seen what was effectively an acknowledgement that this. But we added a new question to the Paycheck Protection Program Frequently Asked Questions. And this is essentially question number 53, which began to explain to us about why some borrowers are getting these forms 3509 and 3510 when they apply for forgiveness. As I said, the starting point here is we actually have the SBA acknowledging this form exists, which I guess is a good thing, right? The form exists. We agree it exists. And we're using it. We confirm that we are sending it out to people. Now, one nice little detail here that is a little different from what a lot of the first people to get it report is that they were told you had 5 days to respond. The SBA now says, no, if you get this, you have 10 days to respond. Now, the only bad news is, yes, you know, they write about a little less than a page on this issue. And they give us some limited information about what they plan to do with the data on. If you've taken a look at, and by the way, 3509 and 3510 are also now available for download from the SBA's website over on the part related to lenders section. So, yeah, you have to be a lender because the theory is the lenders get this form, and once they see they have a loan of over $2 million or $2 million group, they then send this questionnaire out, and you have to fill it in. Remember, the questionnaire asks you information about whether your revenues went down in the second quarter of comparing the second quarter of this year, second quarter of last year. We have a couple of other options there. They take a look at if you've been spending money on things that, you know, for capital improvements that aren't COVID related. They took a look at if you're paying people more than $2,000 annualized while you're on the loan. They have all of these questions. And they haven't really told us for sure what they're going to do about it, except that it is pretty clear that they are using it to try to identify taxpayers they believe may have not made a good faith certification that they needed the loan. Those borrowers that are in that category, well, they may have some additional explaining to do, or they could have a disallowance. One thing to remember, this only affects loans that are $2 million or more. The SBA announced after a bunch of back and forth early in the program that they essentially have conceded, effectively, they're just going to assume anybody who got a loan of less than $2 million is not, you know, had a need for the money. Not. Which I think is the way I'd phrase it. So this is not a problem if your clients are below the $2 million level. However, if you have a client who's above $2 million in borrowing, they're going to get this information. As I said, most of it is forward-looking, right? What did you do after you got the money? Rather than concentrating on why did you think you might need the money going forward with COVID. Now, they do say that if they have an issue with you, they kind of say they're going to do this, but then you can read it all so that maybe they might not in all cases, but that they would contact you and give you a chance to explain if it appears based on your post-loan activities and your post-loan results for the business that, we're not sure you needed this loan. They will, however, let you explain. And they do at least say here that we are talking about why you felt that the loan was necessary based on the information you had at that time to continue to operate the business. So, you know, they want to hear you explain that. So, bottom line, this information, if you have a client with over a $2 million loan, I would certainly suggest going and getting the updated frequently asked questions. By the way, basically, there are two FAQs here. The main FAQ, which is this one that we've been going with back since very, very early in the program. I think the first part, one of these showed up in April, and we've been getting them ever since. Sometimes updated quickly, sometimes they don't change for a while. This is an add-on to that. Then there is one specifically toward forgiveness. That's the other FAQs. There are two FAQs you got to watch for here. And you have to make sure you have the most recent one. And as of the time I'm recording this, the December 9th FAQ is the most recent. So say the upper left corner as of December 9th, and you will have question 53 that deals with this issue. Your client who got a more than $2 million loan really should be reading over what the SBA is saying about why they're doing this, what the purpose is, and then I think you may help the client say, well, look, if we look at this and we're trying to figure out, does it appear you needed the loan? That's how they're going to make that decision. So if it appears that that might be answered, I don't see how they need it, then we need to go back and start getting ready our justification for the concerns we had back when we applied for our PPP loan based on the uncertainty. Because let's face it, it was an uncertain period. In fact, I remember reading an article today, I forget what the paper it showed up in, but I've been analyzing the PPP loan documents, and it was going wild, which probably is a little good, over the fact that a lot of, they were actually picking on Sonic, franchisees got the PPP loans. But one thing which they point out there that I think was kind of helpful to understand this and why it might appear you didn't need the loan, but it turns out you did. Now, they did say that, you know, these franchisees, when the program first started, by the way, I should say, it was talking about franchisees, not Sonic per se. That was also one area of confusion here. The reason why the article's coming up is because there are currently discussions going on, and it appears that those who are behind writing this, which I think primary authors of the program, the Senator Rubio and Senators Rubio and Cardin, who are on the Small Business Committee for the Senate, they seem to be leaning against allowing larger entities to borrow on a future program if we get it, as well as limiting the access for franchisees of large organizations. Amazingly, they have discovered that the people that got these loans were the people that could do what I called early speak bank, right? People that had a banking relationship tended to get in, get these loans at the very instant, immediately. Those who were not so good at speaking bank, they didn't tend to get it. There was a reason why we're very heavy in the construction industry. Remember the industries that got this, why was construction so heavy? Because honestly, most construction companies are all, you know, they're used to borrowing at the bank. They're used to dealing with bonding companies. They can speak bank. They can go ahead and get this done. Well, the catch was what they were explaining though, if you had a mainly drive-through restaurant, when the initial COVID cases hit, and remember early on, there was a lot of concern. People weren't sure how it was transmitted. And so we had all these people, you were concerned about everything, right? Doesn't matter. Worried about everything. Now, over time, it has become a lot more clear that transmissions tend to be by air and that there's not a whole lot of risk of getting a bag, you know, with the hot dog or the hamburgers in it, right? And taking that home. That's not going to infect the world because it's a tainted bag. But early on, though, people didn't go by those places. You know, they stopped. They just cut back and didn't do any of that. But following that, what's happened now is those type of drive-through restaurants are actually doing at least as well, if not better, than they were doing before. And that's something that I think is appropriate to think about in this case. There definitely are businesses that back then, because again, we didn't know what COVID was doing. We didn't know how it would impact. We didn't know how it would play out. There were a lot of people that were concerned, you know, about it, even though it turned out that once we found out how this whole thing's going to run out, that, you know, their industry, their business really wasn't suffering that much. And so now it's a little bit more difficult to say, well, looking back, if you'd have known everything you know today, did this business need a loan? Probably not. But given the uncertainty at the time, that's what you're going to have to write out and kind of let them know. Now, there's one other big thing I think we should mention, again, that's in the news, but we don't have anything to tell you yet. I'm recording this on Saturday, you know, early Saturday afternoon here in Phoenix. And as of today, we have had, yesterday on Friday, we had an extension that gave the Congress another week to get the spending bill together. They are still working on a new COVID package to go with the spending bill. Depending upon what, you know, who you read, what time, and, you know, where you find it, we're either close or not close at all, or it's never going to happen, or it's just about done. And like I said, I ignore all of that until we get a bill passed by both houses, signed by the president. No, it's not done yet. But they are working on that. So you do need to be aware that we might have that sort of change over the next week. And if we have that sort of change, the program probably will give us a new loan program. There is a lot of discussion that if there is such a program, it will be limited to those that can show some sort of decrease in revenue compared to last year. So if you're not, if you didn't have that decrease, you probably won't qualify. Also, they will let some companies get a second run at the program. As long as you had the decrease, we will let you borrow again and, you know, direct it that way. So we have to keep our eyes on what's going on there. That's going to be one of those things coming forward. Keep your eye this week on that area. Just don't know how it's all going to play off. Well, we're getting here toward the end of the year. I got a couple of more courses coming up for Arizona this week. And depending upon how early you read this, we may or may not be too late to get in on one of these, but we'll see. Coming up on Monday, so if you get this before the weekend's over, I'll be doing an Arizona income tax update and overview. That'll be on Monday morning. We'll talk there about, for those of you in Arizona, Prop 208 and how that works. That is Arizona's half millionaire's tax. We'll also talk about Prop 207's income tax. And, you know, Prop 207 is legalizing the marijuana. We'll talk about the fact that that also makes a change to Arizona law to take Arizona law away from compliance with the federal 280E restrictions on deducting expenses. So we'll talk about that and other things in that one. Then the afternoon, as long as we're talking about 207, I'll be talking about the course on accounting, auditing, and tax considerations for the cannabis industry. That's a four-hour session. On Tuesday, I will be doing my last live session at a state society for this year on the current federal tax developments, that full-blown version, I should say. I'll be doing other updates before the end of the month, but this is the last one. That'll be the full 8 hours, and it'll run on the 15th. Now, on the 16th, I'll have a rebroadcast on CalCPA. That'll be a rebroadcast of a program that was actually recorded in November. So I've discovered now we're going to be a little bit further back, so try to get some materials together for anybody who takes that course, know what's happened since the date it was recorded, you know, to see what's really changed, but be aware of that. But this one on Tuesday from the Arizona Society is a live course. I think it's scheduled for rebroadcast in January at some point, so we'll have to see how all that runs. I will be doing other courses. If we get a bill on COVID, I do expect to be putting together some courses on that. Whatever happens with a COVID bill, if we are interested in such a course, please contact once the bills come out. You might ask your state society if they want to get in contact with us here at Kaplan. We can see about setting up such programs to do it for whatever the appropriate amount of time is. That's also, since we don't know what the bill is, we also don't know how detailed the bill is and whether it is a 1 hour, 2 hour, 4 hour course. I guess conceivably an 8 hour course, depending upon how complicated the bill gets on the things we'll touch. So we'll have to see about that. But yeah, we expect to be doing that coming up. Again, it's been Current Federal Tax Developments this week for the week of December 14th. Get the right date in there. If you want to email me, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. My Twitter handle is @edzollers, so you can catch me there. I also do follow the societies that I'm a member of, so I will follow the Connect sites. You want to post on the Connect sites, you're a member of these societies, Arizona, Illinois, Minnesota, Jersey, and Washington. If I see something, I'll try to respond to those. So, you know, if you have something, you got an issue, let me know. We'll go there. Otherwise, we'll see what comes this week. Now, obviously, if we're going to get a COVID bill before the end of the year, this is probably the most likely week because Congress really wants to get out of town on Friday. If they don't finish it up this week, then we'll figure out if they're just going to punt and do a spending bill that takes it into the next Congress, which means we start over, which means we probably wouldn't see a COVID bill, I don't think, until certainly until after inauguration. and I suspect probably not until sometime in February, or if we'll get something before this Congress leaves. And the other catch is, if they're not done Friday, then they might decide to stay around. They have an advantage that Christmas itself is basically on a Friday, right? It's going to come up a week from this coming Friday. So that gives them some time next week to get it passed and still get out before Christmas is over. Or they might even go the extra, which I really don't think they'd want to do, considering that this Congress disappears at the end of the year. You know, your job's done at December 31st. But they could come back after Christmas for a few days. But I don't see that as likely unless they had a bill and they were simply coming back for a vote to deal with it. So we're coming back to vote as opposed to, you know, coming back to try to negotiate and get everything done and passed before midnight on the 31st. So we'll probably have some much better clue about how the COVID bill is coming by the end of this week. But in any event, I'll see you next week. We'll talk about what's going on as we do our work here on current federal tax developments.